Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, again, no comments today, but again, I think that's such a good thing because we have a lot to talk about. So last time, we began our discussion of Lawrence's life at Oxford. Now, we didn't really get too far into it, so for today's program, we're going to jump right back into that discussion. And today, to help me do this, the 60-plus panel is back together again. So welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So I do think it's interesting that just as everything else in his life, when Ned attended Oxford, it was on his own terms.
That's true.
I guess we should not be surprised, you know, so. But I just thought for a minute, I mean, I said in the last program, I've never attended Oxford, but I do think that the British education, and of course, all of you people in Britain that are listening to this program, you could always write me and tell me if I have this right, or maybe you could write and give me some better insight into what goes on at Oxford. But I just assume from what I've read about Oxford that there is a lot expected of each student to kind of like educate themselves. In other words, there's a lot of independent research. Now, I know that they also have what they call a tutor, and they have to have maybe 1 to 4 sessions with a tutor a week. So this tutor is guiding them. And then also, I think the tutor also assigns them essays that they have to write for him on what they're doing. But I also understand that there's lectures, there's seminars, there's classes they attend. So I'm not sure how that works. And I have a feeling that's probably just a little bit different than, what we would say have at American colleges. But the thing is, what I think is hilarious and maybe not so hilarious is that Corder just says, Lawrence was even a special case at Oxford. I mean, he did things the way he wanted to do. And so here's what Corder says on page 155. He says, Lawrence, as so often in his life, was a special case. Unlike his classmates, he did not live at his college. They had assigned rooms, usually a sitting room, study, and a bedroom. There were several rooms to a staircase, with a scout, which was a combination of a valet, a butler, and a housemaid to look after the residents. Rooms were arranged from medieval discomfort to palatial grandeur according to the student's ability to pay and according to an indecipherable social code in the office of the bursar who made the assignments. So it just really seems like a lot of Oxford seems like a lot of the more uppity you are, the more you're pampered. And, of course, Lawrence did not have to live at Oxford. For one, he lived in Oxford. And then, two, he had his own cottage, which seems to me like it would have been much better than a room at Oxford. And, of course, maybe I should also say that Oxford isn't just one big college. It's a group of colleges, and each one has its own name. And because Lawrence had qualified for history— he went to Jesus College. But there was a, again, it's just so different, I think, than the way everything's organized in America. So notice he goes on to say here, it says, in Lawrence's day, it was quite common for undergraduates to be served breakfast, lunch, or tea in their rooms, and for those who could afford it, full dinner parties with a special menu and wines chosen from the college's cellar. So that would never happen in American colleges today.
Although it may have happened partially, in the you know, earlier days, you know.
Like at Harvard.
Yeah, at Harvard or something.
Or Yale, right.
I mean, you know, this in the Victorian age, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, but there was social class was really important at this point, especially in England. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, I do think it was different, but again, he was special. He was able to maintain, you know, his way of doing things and still go to Oxford, which again I think is just interesting. But I don't think we necessarily need to get into you know, his principal tutors and all that. I think people can read that for themselves. What I think is the most interesting thing about this chapter is on Oxford is that the number one thing that Corder brings out is that he had most of his fun at Oxford by breaking the rules and the regulations.
Yes.
So the are we surprised? No, we're not surprised. So this is in the middle of the chapter. This is page 161. And there's a lot of things we're going to skip in the chapter that I don't think are necessary to discuss on the radio and are really not, you know, part of the whole Lawrence story. So, but this is the bottom of page 161. It says, despite his peculiarities, Lawrence, like other undergraduates, sought fun in breaking rules and regulations and in the kind of pranks that seemed daring and hilarious at the time, but may not necessarily seem so many years later when they are retold. So I think it's funny. So, to me, it just seems typical of Lawrence. We know that he really was a practical joker. He'd done a lot of practical joking with his parents and with his brothers. It's not surprising to me that he was out there doing daring and hilarious things at the college when he could. But I thought it was one of the funny things is, and I was really surprised at this. It says, Lawrence, like many undergraduates over the centuries, became an expert at climbing the walls and towers of the Oxford colleges. So it's kind of like I got the idea of Spider-Man here.
Yeah, so it sounds like it was a challenge that, like I said, a lot of them did, you know, over the centuries. So something that they enjoyed doing, you know, young men like to challenge themselves.
It's like, it's kind of like the Victorian version of rock climbing.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So I, you know, I can't imagine at the University of Pittsburgh me climbing the Tower of Learning, you know.
But probably with someone to try at some point.
Oh, I'm sure some crazy guy did probably. I would never have attempted it, but that would have probably been a challenge for T.E. or Ned. Or to E. Lawrence to climb the Tower of Learning in Pittsburgh. So, but I think it's interesting that he did have somewhat of a purpose for climbing the walls during the day, and it said that he liked to take photographs, and you know that's one of the things that I think he really loved about his father. His father was a great photographer, and I understand from reading Corda's book that Lawrence was a gifted photographer, and you know, he was actually, even when he was beginning to take photographs at Oxford, he was getting ready for his thesis. You know, so I do think that's kind of interesting. Now, they said he climbed at night because of you know, he wanted to be amused at night, so it's probably there was some big challenge of doing it in the dark. You know, I can't imagine there was a lot of streetlights in Oxford at that time, unless they were probably gas lights or something like that. So the one of the big things, and I guess this probably may not mean a lot to us, but supposedly that there was this classic climb to go from Balliol College to Keble College. And I guess that must have been a real challenge to go from college to college. And they did that at night. And, you know, it says that his mother, I think this is the top of page 162, his mother vigorously denied that Ned ever left his cottage in the garden to crawl around the roofs of Oxford at night. She said that he was always home by midnight. So Corda says, yeah, that was kind of like the, you know, a loving mom saying he would never do that. When actually, you know, at the college he did have what they called a crammer. So he would had a tutor and he had a crammer. I guess the crammers helped him cram for exams. And that's something I can think of. They must have been, you know, experimental or very experienced, I should say. Maybe not experimental. They could be very experienced at, you know, taking tests. And often he would be with his crammer till 4 in the morning. So you see, he was in the cottage. He was away from his parents' house, so they really didn't know what he was doing. But his mom, you know, like any good mom, would, you know, stand up and fight for him. So I would think he probably was very much involved in this classic climb from Balliol College to, you know, Keble College. And again, maybe anybody from England that's familiar with Oxford could maybe even write in and tell us about this climb and how it worked. But anyway, that's not the only thing he did. There's a quarter brings out that one time he was studying, you know, at the college for 45 hours straight, no food, no sleep. And then what he did, he began to shoot blanks out of the window from the room he was studying in. So that to me doesn't sound that exciting. But I guess if you were, you know, trying to scare somebody.
Maybe that would help keep him awake.
Maybe that helped keep him awake. I don't know. Or else he was just insane from studying for 45 right. hours mm-hmm. with no food or sleep. Now, the other thing that the Corda lists is one of his favorite pranks or pastimes was to take a canoe trip on what they call the Trill Mill Stream. And when I first read that, I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. That doesn't sound like that much of a prank. And then you realize it's going into the sewers of Oxford. So it would not be the big pleasant canoe trip because you're into the city. And then again, you take your gun with you and you shoot blanks up through the vents in the city. And so
yeah, it said it was under the streets of Oxford. So
yeah.
Yuck.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I don't know. But I guess that was a big challenge. And I guess, you know, he led the pack of canoers that would do that. And, you know, so I think it just kind of shows, his personality. But then I think Corda does a great job of summing it all up. It says, despite his eccentricities regarding nourishment and sleep, Lawrence's years at Jesus did not seem all that different from the usual undergraduate experience. In those days, there was a deep social divide between the exhibitioners, or the bright young men who had won a partial scholarship and were expected to work hard and earn a first, and young men from well-to-do families and public schools for whom Oxford was more likely to be a social experience. Lawrence and his friends were clearly in the former group, basically serious, hardworking, and determined to do well, but not adverse to the occasional prank. Indeed, Lawrence's taste for practical jokes, for pulling the legs of people naive enough to believe him, was apparently already fully developed and would not invariably seem among his most endearing qualities. So if anybody was going to pull your leg, it was going to be T.E. Lawrence. All right, I've been talking a lot, so what do you have to say about all that?
Well, it just shows that he, although he did go on his own, you know, in his own way, he was really not that different from other young men at the time, too. Because, I mean, doing pranks, it does seem like that's something they did at college. So
yes.
So and it does show that he did have friends, too. Somewhere else it says that he did have friends, and people respected him and enjoyed his company. So he liked being by himself, but yet he was not adverse to being with the other young people as well.
No, I think Corda brings out a really good point, that he was actually a very likable person.
Yes, right. I read that. Yes, I remember reading that.
Yeah, and the mm-hmm. the people actually really liked him. He could mm-hmm. be, he may have been a loner, but you know, it's not like he wasn't sociable.
Right. He was likable, and it seems like there are several people that end up being his mentors, you know, some of these men who he respected, and they really respected him and appreciated him.
Right.
And he could, because he was likable. They could see his talent, but also he was likable.
Right. Even, you know, as we get into his first journey to the Middle East, you know, he was really pretty bold. He went up against, you know, Hogarth was a famous archaeologist, and well, I didn't plan to get into that right now, but we'll get into that. He challenged them on, you know, on the way they thought, and you know, so but they did, like you said, they really did respect him. So, but I think it's interesting that you know, he did come from a well-to-do family, even though they didn't know it. But he was in the toughest part of Oxford. I mean, he was in where they really expected them to produce, and it wasn't just there for the social thing. And but he of all people could really produce, and I think that's why he did so well there. And I think Korda makes a really good point that there was one aspect of him that was different than the other undergraduates. And the fact is that he did have a firm sense of what he wanted to do with his life. And I know when I went to college, I changed my major, you know, midstream. And, you know, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do. In fact, I think I changed it twice. And so that seems to be, you know, a big thing at the colleges today is that, you know, how many majors are you going to choose before you actually choose what you want to do with the rest of your life? And then some young people actually leave college not having a clue as to what they want to do with the rest of their life. But he definitely, you know, had this firm idea of what he wanted to do. And guess what it was? I'll read it to you right from Korda. This is page 163. He still had Byronic fantasies of becoming a hero and of liberating people. It was not clear yet which people he had in mind, but he had more than a layman's interest in military history, strategy, and tactics, but his interest in archaeology and medieval buildings was the strongest focus of his work at Oxford. So again, the underlying thing in his life was he still wanted to be a hero, and he still wanted to liberate people. And of course, it was really his love of archaeology that led him to the Arabic peoples. And that's, he found his people. He found his people when he was digging up things. And again, that's really interesting. I think it's also, I think one of the things that Korda brings out is that it seems like he also knew where his talents were. I mean, he became a great cartographer. He became really a very good photographer. And some of his photographs are just stunning. And so here's what Lawrence says. He said, revealingly, Lawrence chose to write a thesis on medieval fortifications about which he already knew a good deal, indeed perhaps more than his examiners. The subject would have the further advantage of allowing him to make use of his growing skill as a photographer and a cartographer, as well as providing a good reason for spending the vacations away from home. Warfare was never far from his mind, despite his other interests. So he decided to do his thesis on, you know, the medieval fortifications and the castles and all of that, and so he had to begin preparing that. I know that when I did my master's program, I did, one of the primary reasons I took the library information science degree is I didn't have to produce a thesis. You know, because that's just a lot of work. You know, he had to work several years on this thesis project. And so, you know, but I think it's fascinating there that they said that he probably knew more than his examiners. And so it just shows, you know, what what he was like. Now, I also think that what's interesting is once he decided on that thesis, then he really went after it. I mean, he did not just dilly-dally around. And I know sometimes when I have to write an article, it takes me like a good 15, 20 minutes just to get focused and say, okay, I'm going to really do this now. He seemed like he could go after it. And once they decided on what that thesis was, he takes off on this marathon bicycle tour of France. And he goes there to look at all the castles, look at all the churches. And he did a 2,400-mile tour of France. He was taking photographs, he was doing rubbings, he was doing drawings, and he was collecting all of this for his thesis. And so that was evidence very early on, like when he was a child. If he was interested in something, he just devoted himself to it. But I think it's really interesting that you studied in France and you studied with the French people, but he really didn't like hanging around with the French.
not as much as he ended up liking the Arabs.
Yes. No, mm-hmm. Yeah. He just was really impatient and with the French. And actually, even Korda brings out that when he went to the Paris Peace Conference after the war, he still was impatient with the French. And, I guess the French just have that way of maybe it's their supreme self-righteousness or, they just love themselves so much that they just have that effect on people that, oh, yeah, you're just a pain to be around. So, but anyway, he spoke French fluently.
Yes.
He loved the French language. Mm-hmm. He loved the French castles, and even on that, I'm not going to get into it too much, but even on that trip, he went to one area of France where it was just infested with mosquitoes, and he was like bit everywhere by mosquitoes. But those things didn't seem to bother him. He could endure, this physical trauma, but he liked it. 2,400 miles on a bike. Collecting all things for his thesis is really amazing. One thing I think it's interesting that Korda brings out in all this is that he made sure he always wrote his mother. And so I think you can see he may have resisted his mother's discipline, but he still had a lot of respect and love for his mother. And top of page 164, it says, 10 days later, when he writes from Aigues-Mortes in Provence, the fact that his attention is moving toward the Middle East is repeated in a kind of poetic vision that prefigures his travels there. He said, this is to his mother, I rode to Le Beau, a queer little ruined and dying town upon a lonely olive-sandaled mountain. Here I had a most delightful surprise. I was looking from the edge of a precipice down the valley far over the plain, watching the green changing into brown, and the brown into a gray line far away on the horizon, when suddenly the sun leaped from behind a cloud and a sort of silver shiver passed from the gray. Then I understood and instinctively burst out with a cry of, I can't read the Greek.
I have no idea.
Yeah, but it's thalaza, thalaza, that echoed down the valley and started an eagle from the opposite hill. The shot of the Greeks in Xenophon's Anabasis, that's what thalaza, thalaza is from, when they at last glimpsed the Black Sea shining in front of them after their 1,000-mile retreat from what is now Iraq, came naturally to a young man steeped in the classics as Lawrence was, but more important, it was his first distant glimpse of the Mediterranean. Today, we can have no idea of what it then meant to a well-educated young Englishman. The Mediterranean is now just a few hours away by plane, and its shores are an endless array of tourist destinations. But in the first decade of the 20th century, it was still the focal point of a European imagination, culture, and respect for the past. a world at once classical and deeply romantic. A day later, Lawrence reached the sea, bathed in it, writing afterward to his mother, "I felt at last I had reached the way to the south, and all the glorious east, Greece, Carthage, Egypt, Tyre, Syria, they were all there and all within reach. I would accept a passage for Greece tomorrow." Well, eventually that didn't happen because he could not get a passage to Greece, but he would have been off to Greece. He would have left France and been gone. So we're out of time again for today's program. So next time I'll give you some more information on Lawrence's time at Oxford. We'll continue this discussion. So remember, for this current series of programs, we're using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. There is still plenty of time for you to read this book and catch up with us. You can buy the book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at ABEbooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can also follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.